Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is the philosopher Robert M. Ellis. Robert is the creator of Middle Way Philosophy, a practical philosophy working out the implications of human uncertainty and embodiment for every aspect of our lives, and he's also the founder of the Middle Way Society. He has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Lancaster and has earned a living as a teacher, lecturer and tutor. He's here to talk to us about his latest book, The Christian Middle Way, The Case Against Christian Belief but for Christian Faith, published by Christian Alternative, which comes out on the 27th of July. He'll also be running a weekend retreat on the Christian Middle Way from the 20th to the 20th of July, which will give people an opportunity to explore its approach at the Brazier's Park Centre in the lovely Oxfordshire countryside. Anyway, without further ado, hello Robert, welcome back once again to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, Robert, what was it that prompted you to write the book?
Well, I've been writing about Middle Way philosophy for some years, as you know, but during the last few years, my writing's taken a slightly different turn, which is you could roughly call exploration of my roots and particularly religious roots. And this particular book was the beginning of that process, really. And I think it was sparked more than anything by my father's death in 2015. So my father was a Baptist minister and missionary.
Yeah.
And I began to realize after his death, in the way one reflects after one's father dies, really, that about the positive things he'd given me. And one of those, I think, was an experiential relationship to Christianity. So even though I rejected the absolute beliefs of Christianity from quite an early age, I also began to appreciate and explore what was positive in that Christian tradition.
Okay. Well, let's just dive in then, Robert. Then, so what does the Middle Way have to do with Christianity?
Well, the Middle Way in general is a principle of judgment, as I understand it, which allows us to navigate between the absolute extremes, positive or negative. Now, so that's a universal principle which you can apply in any context. And obviously people are most familiar with it in context of Buddhism. But in recent years, I've been exploring very much how it can be applied in lots of different areas. And Christianity always had to be one of them. So in theory, I've always had this idea. And so this book is really a more detailed exploration of that. I think one of the central things that struck me here is the way in which Christ for Christians can function as a symbol of the Middle Way. In ways when Christians engage with Christ in a particular experiential way rather than dogmatically, that there's this attempt to bridge this massive gap between the divine and the human, between the perfect and the imperfect. So that creates this open space, this dialectic between an idea of perfection, idea of imperfection, and people's relationship to the figure of Christ is a response very often to that dialectic, I think.
Okay, so what's the distinction then, Robert, between faith and belief that's made in the subtitle, the case against Christian belief but for Christian faith?
Well, this is a central part of my approach, really, and the way in which I want to connect with how Christians experience their faith. So belief, or Christian belief as generally understood, is an absolute belief. So belief that God exists, belief that Jesus saves people from sin and so on. But Christian faith is as I'm interpreting it here, is an experiential matter. It's based on meaning, and meaning is something that we experience primarily in our bodies, which is, it's built up from infancy through a series of associations and metaphors. So faith is it appears to be bound up with belief. So people very often assume that faith depends on belief. But the case I want to make in this book is that faith can actually be separated from belief and is actually better off without it. So if we're clear about the need to avoid absolute beliefs, then it's also possible to find faith in the sense of an embodied confidence in a God that people experience, that is an archetypal God that they can relate to directly, rather than an abstract conception of this perfect and absolute being who exists in some entirely abstract fashion. So in a nutshell, that's it really. It's that belief is a purely abstract, conceptual, and in its absolute form an unhelpful thing, whereas faith, well, we all have faith in various things, embodied, confident, immediate faith, and Christianity is no exception to that. So celebrating Christian faith is the positive thing that I try to find in this book by separating it from belief.
And are you offering something completely new here, or would you find a similar approach or a certain resonance with other approaches in the Christian tradition that emphasise the experiential side of things? I'm thinking of, like, in the Protestant tradition, the Quakers or the mystics in the Catholic tradition.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I have been influenced by some of those streams in Christianity, particularly admiration of the mystics, and indeed I've had some connection with Quakerism, and indeed also by Don Cupid, who was one of your earlier interviewees quite a while ago now, who taught me at Cambridge, in fact. But what's new about this, I think, is just the constant use of the concept of the middle way, which I just haven't found anywhere in Christian literature or Christian theology. So I think it really is about time it was applied in a Christian context. There were comparisons of Christianity and Buddhism. So people like Thich Nhat Hanh, for example, have written quite movingly about that. But so very often it's just a, when Christianity and Buddhism are compared, it's often comes across as a form of naive universalism, in the sense that people just assert that they're the same in some ultimate way. I don't think that helps very much if you're not critical, if you don't sort of try and sort out what's helpful and unhelpful in each tradition. So I want to sort the unhelpful from the helpful bits of Christianity, and the same with Buddhism. And the most helpful aspect of Buddhism is all connected to the middle way, in my view.
And would you call yourself a Christian?
Only in a cultural sense. I haven't been through the formal process of that Christians would often use to define what a Christian is, which involves accepting baptism and reciting the creed and so on. Since I was brought up in a Baptist household, in fact, I was never baptized, so I was never christened. So, no, I'm not a Christian in that sense. And if people define Christianity in terms of absolute belief, I'm not a Christian in that sense. But culturally, I'm imbued with Christianity, and I'm much more a Christian than any other religion, I think. So I have a strong relationship to Christianity in a cultural sense, but I also value a strong relationship with Buddhism. So I'm kind of bi-religious in that sense.
Okay. And also another big influence on you and your work is Carl Jung. So what influence did he have over this book?
Carl Jung has influenced me throughout my writing, really, but particularly the key ideas of integration and archetypes are important to middle way philosophy. But probably one big influence actually on me just before the time I wrote this book was Jung's Red Book and reading his Red Book for the first time, this extraordinary series of archetypal visions and reflections that Jung wrote down more than 100 years ago now. And amongst those is a strong kind of exploration of Jung's relationship with God. And it's quite clear all the way through the Red Book, as elsewhere in Jung, that he's not talking about a supernatural existent being. He's talking about something he experiences inside his own psyche, which is a kind of, it's a way of talking about a potential for integration, which you glimpse in experience. But I mean, the great thing, particularly with the Red Book, I think, is that it seems just as strong an experience. It's not weakened by the fact that it's recognized as psychological. It's not a reduction in any sense. It's the real thing, if you like. It's real religious experience. And that's entirely compatible with the recognition that God is something we relate to in our own experience.
On that point, Jung's famous statement, I don't believe in God, I know him. Do you understand that to mean I don't believe in God, but I find God meaningful?
That's how I'd like to interpret it, although I have actually been given pause and, you know, I've reconsidered that interpretation somewhat, because I think I'm more inclined these days to say Jung is inconsistent. So I don't think he's justified in saying he knows God. But I think what lies behind that experientially and helpfully is, you know, I experience God. I have a direct, meaningful relationship with God. Yes. That's how I would helpfully interpret that statement. Let's put it that way.
Okay. And then another huge influence on you in the last few years is the work of Ian McGilchrist on brain lateralization. So how did that understanding relate to this book?
There's a whole way in which one can explore this in relation to, you know, the left hemisphere God and the right hemisphere God. And there's Rod Tweedy's book about this, which you interviewed Rod a little while ago on, called The God of the Left Hemisphere, which explores that in relation to Blake. So, yes, I mean, the left hemisphere has this entirely conceptualized, often sort of self-sufficient and thus dogmatic approach to things. If left too much to itself, if disconnected and allowed to over-dominate the right hemisphere. So it seems to me that the belief in God, the insistence that God is a matter of belief, is very much a product of the over-dominant left hemisphere. So if our brains are operating with a better balance, with sufficient communication between the hemispheres, then we should be able to access a right hemisphere experience of God, and our conceptual beliefs should be able to adapt to that, you know, to adopt a more balanced and helpful understanding of what God is, rather than this sort of belief which results in repression and holy war and inquisitions and all those other things which we know so well as the product of absolutized religion.
What's your attitude to the Bible? Can that really be understood in middle way terms too?
I think it can if we interpret it responsibly. I mean, the Bible is constantly cherry-picked, and confirmation bias is the basis on which people generally interact with it, and that includes its critics as well as its the people who believe in it absolutely. But the basis on which I relate to the Bible is well, I call it the principle of interpretive responsibility. So we're always going to have confirmation bias. We're always going to pick out the elements of text that support our position. And if we're going to do that, then it's better it's a helpful position that we're trying to support. And the helpfulness of that position needs to be justified in relation to our experience, not in relation to some appeal to historical events or authorities that the text is supposed to be referring to. So I don't take the Bible as a source of authority in any sense, but I do find it a possible source of inspiration. And I try and relate those inspirations to things that we can justify in other ways through experience.
Could you perhaps give us an example of that?
Okay, well, one of the things I write about quite early on in the book is the creation. Very often this is treated in terms of, God as this external being who creates the world. And is that true or not? Or is it the Big Bang and all that kind of debate? The way I have to say it's the other way around. So I want to ask, well, what sort of meaningful experiences are encapsulated for us, or can we relate to the creation story? So I concluded that we can responsibly interpret it as being about human creativity. So it's a process, the process of creation, which doesn't consist just of a left hemisphere absolute design, whereby you've got a very fixed idea of something and you want to produce it exactly as you intended it to be, but a more open kind of creativity is a right hemisphere creativity, where there's an element of surprise, that there are new things arising, the unexpected occurs. That seems to me to be a good interpretation of what's helpfully going on in that story, that God creates these things and there's a newness about it, that there's an openness as he gradually goes from one day to the other and he creates one thing and another thing. And then at the end he saw that it was good. And it seems to me that that creativity is what was basically good about it. It's that goodness lies in the process that is depicted there, rather than sort of absolute beliefs you can derive from it.
That's interesting. We talked about Jung, and you mentioned the term archetype. Would it be possible just to unpack that a bit more when you say that God is an archetype?
An image I like to use here, if we're trying to relate the experience of God to, you know, an archetypal idea, I suppose, is that supposing you're standing on a mountain and you're looking down and it's pitch dark, but you're looking towards a plain below you. And then suddenly there's a flash of lightning. And in a moment, for a moment, you see the whole plain illuminated before you. And there's a sense of vastness and potential and awe. And I guess it's that kind of experience that is what I mean by experience of the archetypal God. So it's an experience of openness and potential. And you can think of it, you know, a bit more technically maybe as the unification, potential unification of our energies and of our meaning and our beliefs. But it's more that we get a glimpse of that potential for a moment, and that inspires us to work at becoming better people, inspires us to follow the path, which I would take to be the path of the middle way. I mean, archetypes in general are sort of universal human functions. So every person has certain kinds of needs and desires and tendencies and so on, which just come from being human. So you can track those in different ways in different cultures. They have all sorts of different cultural expressions. So God as an archetype could take all sorts of expressions which aren't necessarily about God in the theistic or monotheistic sense. So we've got the treatment of the Buddha in Buddhism, and you could have all kinds of, you know, non-theistic or indeed non-religious expressions of it. So I think the use of the term God is definitely optional, but for those of us from a Christian background who can relate positively to it, the God archetype is potentially a very inspiring thing to relate to.
And then could you also just expand a little bit more about the role of Jesus Christ, and perhaps the difference you see between Jesus as the man and Christ as the symbolic figure?
Yeah, those Jesus and Christ are quite difficult to separate completely, but I suppose the traditional Christian approach to this is, you know, to appeal to a historical figure who somehow proves that, you know, God communicates in certain ways or indeed redeems humanity. But I see Christ as an archetypal figure, who has that kind of role of representing the middle way. So as I mentioned earlier, there's one of the ideas in my book is that Christ, in a sense, is the middle way. Rather than finding it, he is it. He represents it for us, or can do. And the crucifixion and the resurrection can be part of that. So the crucifixion can represent our, the frustration we need, if you like, in order to jolt us out of a closed feedback loop and get us out of rigid ideas about things. That sort of jolt of suffering where we think, when we let go of something, we feel that all is lost for a moment, but then there's the resurrection, there's the unexpected hope of breaking through to a new standpoint, a new understanding of things. So all of that's involved, I think, in the process of following the middle way. So that Christ can represent that, but then Jesus is a historical individual. But again, I'm not really dealing with the historical individual in a historical way. I'm more looking at the stories about him and the stories about his teachings and actions and so on, and drawing out ways in which he can be interpreted as teaching the middle way. So sort of Jesus section of the book is about, for example, Jesus's skepticism, the way he questioned the Pharisees, his emphasis on love, for example. And I mean, if there's something you can take as being very typical of Jesus, it's that he defeats expectations. He's always challenging people, which is a very sort of protean, skeptical kind of way of existing. So he's always teasing us in a way. And that's the That's the biggest thing I get out of the stories about Jesus in the Gospels.
What I also liked about the book, though, you show Jesus as a human side, that he sometimes he was a bit, so he was a bit pig-headed, or he was that he would, or sometimes could be very dogmatic. To me, almost that made him more real in a sense than this cardboard cutout picture that we often get out of him.
Indeed, yeah, I think it's if we're relating to this figure as a exemplar teacher or whatever, it's important for him also to be imperfect and to have these faults, because those are what make him human and allow us to relate our imperfect human experience to his.
Yeah. Okay. Would you say the book represents an ultra-liberal type of Christianity?
Well, in some ways, obviously, it's liberal in that it takes for granted that we make our own judgments about these things, and we don't hang on the authority of tradition or of the past, because we need to make something helpful out of it and relate to it in a helpful way. That's, I guess, a very liberal position, or most Christians would see it as such. But it's not, most liberal Christian churches or theologians still hang on to a lot of the absolute beliefs which traditional Christianity offers, and I'm questioning those. So in a way, I'm trying to avoid some of the assumptions of liberal Christianity as well as more conservative or fundamentalist forms of Christianity. I mean, I guess realistically, it's likely to be liberal Christians who are more interested in what I'm doing than more conservative or fundamentalist ones. But it's not that it's not going to challenge them as well. And I suppose it's the Buddhist elements and the whole idea of the middle way. And Christianity is being about a path of practice. Those are, in some ways, those relate to the mystical tradition in Christianity more, which is largely a Catholic tradition rather than the more liberal forms of Protestantism.
And how do you think the book might help someone who, is an atheist or has a somewhat negative view of Christianity?
Well, I am trying to focus on a lot of positive things we can get from the tradition, as well as the standard criticisms that we get from the new atheists. So I hope that atheists reading this will have new or get new ideas about how they can relate to the Christian tradition positively from it.
Okay. And would you say the book's a call for reform?
Well, it could be interpreted in that way. It doesn't, it doesn't offer a blueprint for reform or anything, but it's more a way of thinking about Christianity, which I think is necessary for any kind of church to really be sustainable, any kind of reformed church to be sustainable. So there's this tendency for there to be wave after wave of reform in the history of Christianity. But in each case, there's a condition that's not being addressed, that, the reformers call for something new. So the dogmas of Catholicism were challenged by Luther, but Lutherans in their turn then became dogmatic in various ways. So for reforming church to be sustained and to do good in the longer term, I think they need the middle way, because, they need an ongoing questioning and a recognition that they're never going to find absolutely correct beliefs about God and so on.
Could you just tell us a little bit more about the retreat you're running in July?
Well, it's going to be in a country retreat centre in Oxfordshire in England, called Braziers Park, which is, comfortable and pleasant environment. As with many of our Middle Way Society retreats, it will have different elements in it. So normally we have meditation and arts and discussion type activities. So the meditation section could be treated as prayer or an open form of prayer for those who want to call it that. So there'll be, a contemplative times. There'll also be some arts activities, but the mainstay of it will be talks and discussion about these kinds of new approaches to Christianity and how the middle way can be applied to Christianity, which will give people the chance to explore it and discuss it and draw their own conclusions about it. I mean, I think it is important to have a context of practice, in the sense that people will be trying to develop more helpful and more open mental states in the context where they discuss these kinds of issues, because it makes it so much more rewarding if people just don't just snap into polarized or dogmatic kinds of discussion, but are open to explore new ways of thinking about things.
Okay. And my last question, what do you think your father would have thought of the book?
Well, I wouldn't expect him to agree with it all at all, but I hope he would sympathize with my motives in you know, trying to find new ways of relating to the Christian tradition. And, you know, he was very, very liberal minded in his approach to Christianity, and it's always obvious to me that he did have, you know, an experiential connection to it. So I hope that there'd be some sympathy, but obviously he'd probably be frank about his disagreements as well.
Okay, great. Okay, well, good luck with the book, Robert. It's been great talking to you today. And also, good luck with the retreat. I've signed up for it, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. I look forward to that too.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.